Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from AltaSpeed Technologies, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open this hour to be a part of the program. It is a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. It's 1-855-450-6624 or send an email to live@AskNoahShow.com. My name is Noah Chalai. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah show kicks off this evening. So one of the things that I've been super passionate about since episode one of this show is getting people unlocked from the chains of bondage of proprietary software and proprietary solutions. I had a major, major win this week. So back in the 90s, my dad started experimenting with MIDI, and he landed on what I still think is the better mousetrap. If you put a song into a computer and record it and encode it, I guess rather, as MIDI, you can then spit that song out on any instrument, at any time, at any tempo, in any key without any degradation to the tone. In fact, if anything, the tone over the years gets better because as synthesizer technology and sampling technology gets better, you can play the same thing out over and over and over again. When I've gone out to perform with other musicians, even musicians that use backing tracks, the modern way of doing that is to do it with pitch bending. Which, and to be honest with you, it's the first time I saw that that was a thing. I was talking to one of the people that I was playing music with, and I said, well, that can't possibly work. And I got this lecture on how great pitch bending technology has become and how these plugins are able to read and do all these things, and you can barely even tell, and it can do. Great. Awesome. Excellent. To its credit, it seems to work well enough that the vast majority of musical groups there don't care. I was talking to my dad about it, and I was like, well, I know MIDI, but all this, you know, all the way that you have all that set up, but the reality is that's a very expensive way to go, right? Because he had to literally hire a musician to play all of those things in. Could you go through and click in all of the notes? You absolutely could. But then it starts to sound robotic or it sounds electronic. If you want it to have that musical, almost human-like touch, you have to have a person, a human being, play it in. And so that's what he did. He hired a musician and gave him a set of songs and said, I want all of this to wind up as MIDI. And the guy played every track in by hand using various different input things, primarily, you know, like a keyboard type of a thing. And so I was telling him, I said, you know, it's a very expensive way. It doesn't scale. The brilliance and the foresight of the pitch bending technology is you can take actual wave tracks of people actually playing the thing, and then you can change it to the various keys. And he kind of laughed at me. He's like, well, go try it and see that there are limitations there. And so I did. And sure enough, you can go up maybe 5-6 steps. And then after that, the software won't let you go any further. I'm sure there's maybe more expensive stuff that can do it, but largely it becomes out of reach. And so he has been married to this way of doing things for a long time. And I admit it's the better mousetrap. Why it burns me, or where this kind of all comes to a head and has a Linux component, I'm sorry for treading on your attention span. Once he got everything dialed in the way that he wanted it, he was understandably reluctant to get out of his little special Snowflake software, which is no longer made. So he, for years and years and years, has been using Cakewalk Sonar, which I don't believe is made anymore. And in order to load his laptop up that he uses, he's gotten to the point where it's such a special snowflake that he has an entire laptop that he uses just for this one purpose, because it takes literally hours to install the version of Windows 7. Then you don't connect it to the internet because doing so causes things to update and activate and then all sorts of things break. So you install a very specific version of Windows, you install a very specific version of Sonar, and then begins the arduous process of one VST after the other, calling these companies, proving that you've paid for them. You have to call in a decommission thing if you're taking it off another machine. It is the biggest pain I cannot begin to put into words what an undertaking reloading that machine is. And I hate every moment of it, to the point that we've largely gotten to the point where we've got images of everything and we can kind of at least have a running start and then just kind of polish off the edges. It's been a sore spot for me for a long, long time. In addition to that, he has an audio interface that only works with this very special FireWire piece of software that runs on Windows. And so he has been tied to this extraordinarily proprietary, extraordinarily difficult to support system for a long time. Now, Steve got an inside look at this a few months ago. He was in Grand Forks for something else, and we were stopped over at my dad's house. We were talking with him, and he said, oh, Steve is very smart. Maybe he knows how to fix this. It's okay. Steve works on containers, not very esoteric Windows. Oh, maybe he can figure it out. So Steve takes his Arch laptop out, fires up a Windows VM, and he can connect and control his audio interface over this Windows VM. So that was kind of a win for a little bit. It worked for a few months, then it stopped working. And now we're back to, we've got the special Snowflake Windows laptop. So all of this comes to a raging halt this week when I find Motu has released a new 18 by 18 USB audio interface. They call it the Ultralight AVB. I'll have a link for you in the show notes, podcast.sknoahshow.com. So this thing is an 18 input, 18 output, processor / audio interface. Now here's the brilliant thing. The entire control software is web-based and it's built into the device. So you buy this device, which is less than $1,000, which if you're in the audio world, that's a great deal for what you're getting. To put that into perspective for you, the Scarlett 2i2, which is a two-channel interface, is like $200 and it has no processing. You plug a microphone in and it is a good quality audio interface, no question about it. But that's all it is a digital audio interface that really does nothing else. The Motu Ultralight AVB is an 18 input, 18 output, and then it also includes processing. So what does that mean? It means you get gating. It means you get reverb. It means you get to process each one of those signals differently. And because it's made from Motu or Mark of the Unicorn, the microphone inputs are fantastic. So it features one microphone level input on the front, one microphone level, mic level XLR on the back, and then it's got the rest of your inputs and outputs via TRS connections at the back. It includes a network interface. Now, the network interface, you set an IP address, and then you browse to the IP address, and it pulls up the entire mixer interface to include all of the processing configuration. They say that you can do up to 36 simultaneous channels of audio. They advertise that it's the most I/O ever offered in an audio interface of that size. By the way, this thing is tiny. I would describe it as like 1U in height, but like it takes up half the U going left to right. So you can fit two of them in a 1U shelf is the best way that I can describe it. This thing is awesome. So where this gets us, where I hope this will get us, we are in the process, we're in the very early onboarding process, but where I sincerely hope that this gets us, I hope that my dad is able to not give up any of the processing and stuff that he's become accustomed to, because he has an 896 MK3, he really likes it, it does all the things that he wants to do, and he's very excited that all of the mixing and the processing fits inside of one box. But of course, to make any changes to the box, you need this esoteric FireWire stuff that only runs on Windows, and it's getting harder and harder to pass FireWire through and get it to connect down to this system. So they're getting harder and harder to support. That's step one, and I think we've eliminated all of that basically in one clean swoop. But the other thing is, now the process begins to see if I can onboard my dad to our tour. Now, I had a chance to catch up with Robin when we were at Ubuntu Summit end of last year. And I spent a lot of one-on-one time with Robin talking about Ardour, how he got things set up. We talked a little bit about his past and his getting into doing cinematic scores. And I got a basic walkthrough of here's how to set Ardour up and use it. Use it as a live mixer. Use it as a DAW, use it as an editing software, use it as a plugin system. He shared with me that he worked with a church who had damage to a very nice organ. And he was able to tweak an organ plugin so that they were able to use Ardour to replace the same sort of sound that they had without having to replace the organ itself. So I guess in a way, this is kind of an invitation. If you're a music nerd out there, we're going to do an episode coming up about music. I've invited a friend of mine who I met at the Southern California Linux Expo. It's actually he and a friend of his. They both heavily into music. The friend does it all on Linux. And so I said, you have to come on the program. We have to talk about this. And so we're going to have somebody that's well ahead of where I'm at producing music on Linux, because I'm just a hobbyist. This guy does it all the time. We're going to have myself, who I'm interested in it. I want to learn more. I like dipping my toes in. When something works, I get excited and I want to do more. And then we're going to drag my dad along for the ride. We're going to try to free him from the chains of his proprietary garbage that takes hours to reload his machine and get him to a place where he can install a distribution, install the piece of software, and go back to making music instantaneously. I think a big, big part of that puzzle was solved this week with the Mark of the Unicorn, or Motu Ultralight AVB. I have a link for you in the show notes at podcast.asknoahshow.com.
From the Linux Newswire newsroom, this is the Week in Review with JT.
For the week of April 14th, 2024, here's the Linux and open source news. After a 10-year hiatus, Dynabolic is back and can be downloaded and used for free. Dynabolic is a live image designed for digital artists and multimedia creators. OpenSSL 3.3 is out. OpenTTD 14.0 is out. Ardour 8.6 has been released. KDE has announced the release of KDE Frameworks 6.1. The classic game Descent 3 from Outrage Entertainment is now available under the MIT license. And things are heating up in the legal battle between OpenTofu and HashiCorp, as OpenTofu has responded to HashiCorp's cease and desist letter. In open source AI news, Hugging Face has updated its multimodal LLM IDEFX model. Meta has announced that it will release a small version of Llama 3 within the next month. And in security news, new Spectre v2 attacks impact Linux systems on Intel CPUs. And the Open Source Security Foundation and the OpenJS Foundation, which backs multiple JavaScript-based open source software projects, has warned that the attempted social engineering observed in April 2024 against XZutils data compression library may not be an isolated incident.
We've talked about the Framework laptop before on the show. It's one of my favorite new toys, and I've been recommending them to friends and people that ask me for advice on what laptop to buy. I also have had an opportunity to start talking to some people that work at Framework, and I've come across some friendly names. Matt Hartley has been put in charge of their Linux support, and I have to tell you, I think that's a great choice, in part because Matt has been living and breathing Linux on the desktop since as long as I've known him. So I want to start here. I had an opportunity to sit down with a friend of mine who's incredibly detail-oriented as he unboxed a Framework laptop. With me is lead installer for AltaSpeed Technologies, Kenny Schmidt. Welcome in.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so you have the Framework 13 in front of you. First of all, you're a very detail-oriented person. You're very artistic, and you have high bars, which I think is really cool. So as you open just the very front of the box up, what are your initial impressions
initial
as you're looking?
Initial impressions. Yes, I love this. So right off the bat, they have this really nice presented envelope with some stickers and all kinds of goodies, and it looks like even a manual of, all the diagrams and stuff. Very cool. The actual print of all the parts come in these little cardboard but nice print quality cardboard printed boxes. So it has right here, we got the input cover kit, so that's the keyboard and trackpad. We have the bezel, which is of course the bezel for the display.
So this bunch of other goodies. This is what's interesting about the way that Framework does this. So they stock all these individual parts, and so far as I understand it, it was a huge logistical concern for them to say, okay, you ordered these exact four modules, but somebody else ordered a different four modules, and somebody else yet ordered a different four modules. Somebody ordered the white bezel, somebody ordered the silver bezel, somebody ordered the black bezel. How do they make it modular and yet cost-effective to ship, because, of course, every time you're shipping a new box, you're shipping a different part. And so a tremendous amount of thought and consideration went into the abilities to package the keyboard sitting on top of the bezel, sitting on top of this structure that then allows you to host the actual computer along with all of the expansion modules. So we've got down to the actual computer itself. How do we actually make this thing work?
Well, I would assume we take it out of the cardboard here and start plugging the pieces in. I mean, I think it's as simple as that, yeah?
So they have a video that shows you how to assemble the framework laptop, but my son didn't know that when he assembled his, and I figured if a 13-year-old can do it without looking at the instructions, then I want to try and do it without the instructions. They also speaks to the ham radio operator in me that, like, if I have to read the instruction book, that takes half the fun out of it. Like, half the fun is reverse engineering what's going on here. And with the framework, that's like an exceptionally pleasant thing to do because it's designed for this. So we got the framework laptop, and out of the box, it is missing the little bezel piece. It's missing, obviously, the keyboard, but they do have a little plastic protective piece that prevents you from sticking your fingers in or accidentally touching any of the internal components. I then had a chance to sit down with Matt Hartley and discuss more in detail how Frameworks is approaching the problem of supporting Linux. With all of the distributions out there, the expectations are just going to vary widely. So I was interested to learn a bit more as to how Framework was going to approach the problem while still maintaining the maximum absence of coercion to let people choose the distros that they want to use on their hardware. I'm here with Matt Hartley. He is the Linux support lead with Frameworks. Matt, welcome in.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
So you are working with Framework, and one of the things that excites me is when I saw what Framework was doing, and I saw that you were the guy that they had doing the Linux support lead, I thought, this is the right guy for the job, because you have lived and breathed Linux on the desktop for a long time. Can you tell me the story of how you got involved with Framework?
That's an amazing question. So initially I applied for a community support manager position, much like what we have with our current one, Des. It turned out that Hacker News was very clear and they wanted better Linux support. And so I was offered a role based on that. And the role evolved and I ended up taking on that position, and I have been just head deep ever since. It's been crazy. Absolutely outstanding. What's incredible is just the sheer amount of passion we're seeing from the community. It's incredible. I don't even know how to make it tangible. It's just so amazing.
So I think one of the things that stands out is I think this is a product that people have wanted for a very long time. People have been looking for a premium Linux computer that is built from the ground up to be maintainable. The people that work in the open source world, like, they want access to the code, they want access to the underpinnings, and this is really kind of one of the first products of its kind. How has it looked from you, from your perspective, in being in that Linux support role? People must come at you with all sorts of questions of, I'm trying this distro, I'm trying that distro, I want to use this software, I want to use that, I'm trying to do this thing with it. It's like drinking from a fire hose, I would imagine.
It is. It's a lot. So one of the first things I did when I came on board is I had to be the really unpopular guy that basically tempered expectations. I said, look, we're going to have to pick two distributions that are going to be officially supported to start with. I am a person of one, and I have one other guy who is working with me, and that's it. And we are absolutely up to our eyeballs. So we started with that. We limited the expectations to official support, and that's going to be Fedora, and that's going to be Ubuntu. We work closely with their teams. We have tremendous support with them, and it's been great. Since coming here, however, I have made contacts with Nix, Debian, SUSE, on and on and on and on. I have a whole list. So we're going to be starting a program, a community support program, to where we're going to work on making sure that we are getting other community members to work on documentation on our behalf to make sure those distributions are represented and we can get that on the landing page. That's our starting point. Getting into software, that's a whole different ball of wax. That's its own conversation. So
I notice when I go looking on the framework forum, every time, and I mean every time, Matt, that there's somebody that has a question, even if you don't have a positive answer for them, even if the answer is, hey, we don't support that distro, what I see from you is, hey, I see that you're running, you know, insert esoteric distro here.
Exactly right.
I don't know how that works specifically, but what I have seen from other people is the other people that are doing that thing have found success by doing this. So even though you only have official support for a couple of distros, you being a person that eats his own dog food and being heavily involved in the Linux community, you look out and you say, okay, I can help you get the answer that you want, even if it's not supported. How has that been, or how have you approached that?
So it's a fine line. I take it as this is a best effort support. This is I label everything very clearly community support, in that I will try to get you on the right path. I will try to get you to the right point. Let's say you're coming at it from Arch, and you're like, I've done everything right, yada, yada, yada. We learned early on with some of the AMD stuff that running Arch with an LTS kernel actually was a better experience. I picked that up from other Arch users. So being a good member of the community, I passed that on. We have threads that run for those things, and we try and direct people into that. But there are times there are misses. There are things we could do better, and we are working on that. But it's been a slog, but we are slowly making progress. But we also have a great community of people that work hard to support each other. Our mods are amazing. They really work hard at keeping it to be a positive experience and a positive environment. And I think it's really paying off. So,
has there been any consideration? So one of the things when you set Linux up on the framework, there is a guide that you follow to make a couple of necessary changes. And I've seen it go back and forth a couple of times where people say, hey, I'm having this problem. Have you checked out this guide? Have you followed all these steps? Yeah. Oh, I've kind of looked at it. Well, have you followed all the steps? Exactly. Because if you do that, you'll have success there. Yeah. And so has there been any conversation or any thought about looking to look at things like Ansible or other automation technologies that could do all of those steps for somebody?
Yes, actually, Ansible is something that I'm looking into right now. Sadly, it's become a cycles issue at this point, because that is like literally tip of a larger iceberg. Ansible is very much something we're looking into. That, and also because things are constantly changing, I have to make sure that everyone's in sync with that, including our other community members and our mods, so that they're up to date with it. But that is something we are looking into. We're just not quite there yet. So my goal is to take some of the lift off my shoulders, so then I can focus on bigger pictures, so I can avoid, here's this one-liner huge one-liner code that you drop into a terminal and it just does all these magical things. What I did with the OEMD kernel, we have a little janky GUI that pops up and tells you, hey, you're out of date, you need to update. You know, it's not ideal, but it's been bulletproof. It's a little old school, but I would like to get more of an Ansible type situation. I think that's going to be the path forward, probably for later this year. So,
you have somebody who has purchased a framework laptop and they're looking at it and they're saying, hey, I've got this problem or that problem. Where should they set their expectations as far as support? How do they reach out and what can they expect in return?
That is an outstanding question, and boy, I wish I could just put this on a billboard because it's so amazing. Step one is you're welcome to run whatever distro you want, but when you come to support and you file a ticket with us, or even in the community support forums to a degree, but especially with tickets, we want to make sure that we're testing against distros that we've banged our heads on every single solitary day. So when I come to work in my office, I generally have 5 laptops open doing 70,000 different things, and they're generally on those 2 distributions, so that's what we're testing against. So that would be the main thing, is to be very clear in that I understand I'm running Arch, I'm having these issues, I would like to try it on Arch first, or I would like to try it on Void first, I'd like to try it on Nix first, but then understand I may need to boot to a live USB and actually do my testing in that environment so that we can establish, hey, is this hardware? Is this a hardware fault? Am I dealing with something that, you know, it's stripping back the onion. It's going back to the most basic core elements of it. And if you're willing to do that, we can get you sorted. But that's the main thing, is to be patient with us, and also with our agents, with our tier one agents. When you come in, they're going to ask you to take a lot of pictures and do things that don't feel relevant. We're building a case so that if it does turn out to be something that is needing hardware attention, we're going to save you a lot of steps later on. So just be patient with us. That's all.
What are your thoughts on the new 16-inch laptop? I see that it's out. I had an opportunity to take a look at it at UbuCon in Latvia late last year, and I see that it's on demo here at Scale. How are you liking it, and what are you anticipating from a support standpoint?
Now, you're talking about Framework 16, you're right. Okay, so with Framework 16, it has been a love child that I enjoy using, but it is tremendously, I think, from the other folks that do the hardware side of the support, making sure all the modules are connected correctly, that the covers are put on right, that's not jacked up and looking weird. I get to skip a lot of that, but I do see a lot of that as well. So I'm liking it a lot, but I find that they're 9 times out of 10, read the guide carefully. you know, be double check your that everything's connected correctly. If something's not happening, are you getting an error? Is there, you know, work through the process. But once you get everything situated and connected, it's an amazing experience. Being able to have LED lights that you're playing Snake or Pong on or whatever. I set up some aliases for, you know, for the event. So folks can come in and type on the keyboard, you know, basically get into a VIA keyboard mindset and play on that, do layers. I mean, do all sorts of stuff. It's fun. It's hard to get work done on it. So I tend to go to the 13 a lot because I play otherwise, because I'll be like, that's right, I got a drive full of Steam games on this, so I'm going to be doing that for my lunch. That's been my challenge, is productivity. So I do find that I work on the 13 more often, because I otherwise I need to swap the drives out and get my games off there.
What can I ask, what the purpose of those little LED things are? So if you're not following what we're talking about, along the sides of the 16 inch there are two little modules, and it's basically a matrix of little LED lights, and I've seen demonstrations where they light up and blink and do all sorts of things. What's the practical reason for those?
For those of you old enough to remember, think Crystal Radio Kit, think Radio Shack, think being able to have something that on the surface doesn't seem to really do anything useful, but what if you piped data into it? What if you had temperature? What if you had your processor frequency? That's what that's for, is that it allows you to pipe different things into it. Right now, we have the option of running a clock on it, or zigzags, or checkerboard, or snake, or pong. But, you know, people are able to do a lot of creative things with it. But I think the benefit of it is seeing folks use it for data, to actually see what's going on, hardware data, having that, like CPU spike, whether it be a graph bar going up and down, or actual digits and numbers. I think that'd be amazing. I think that's where that's going to go. But basically, we just put the stuff out there and see what people do. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Have you dealt, this is kind of outside the scope of support, but have you dealt or dabbled into some of the other projects that people are doing with Framework, things like turning it into desktops and the other cases and those sorts of things, making them repurposable, making them not just a disposable computer?
I have followed from a social, so I run the Mastodon account for Framework. I'm the one that created it, I'm the one that brought it to 15K. I did that from scratch. It was, that was awesome. So we see a lot of those folks sharing these projects and whatnot, and I think they're cool. Unfortunately, I have not had a chance to actually get hands-on with them, mostly because I spend so much of my time in doing QA, end-user testing, just banging my head, making sure everything's good with products that we have out, new things that we're working on, just keeping everything up to date and running. But I've seen some amazing stuff. Some of the best, coolest stuff I've seen was like this, I think it was a handheld with one of the 13 boards. It was like almost like a Steam Deck. It was just crazy, and we've just amazing stuff. I would love to get my hands on one if I ever get a chance, I'll tell you that.
Matt Hartley, Framework Computer. I appreciate the time, sir. Thanks so much. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for your commitment to not just Framework, but also Linux and helping people get situated on the desktop and providing a product for people to do it.
As always, it's been a pleasure.
I also had an opportunity to catch up with Alex Kretschmar. Now, he made the move from Red Hat over to Tailscale, and I was excited to not only learn a little bit more about Tailscale, but also bury some of my preconceived notions. I've been playing with WireGuard since the very early days of WireGuard. I think it's an absolutely fantastic technology. I think someday it is going to eat OpenVPN's lunch. They just have a little ways to go on the user side. Tailscale is an interesting concept because it leverages the power of WireGuard underneath the hood, but it presents it in such an easy and approachable way that anybody, to include system administrators that ship boxes to various places where they don't have control over the network those boxes are going, they have a way to establish a secure encrypted tunnel back into their network. I'm here with Alex Kretschmar from Tailscale. Alex, welcome into the program.
Bonjour. Hello. Good afternoon, Noah. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. So I'm excited to talk a little bit about Tailscale. It's something people are familiar with WireGuard. They've heard of it. They've maybe even played with it a little bit. Tailscale is a way that makes it approachable and easy for anybody to get WireGuard up and running, particularly if you're a small business or a development company that's looking to get access to a number of different devices. Can you tell me the story of kind of how Tailscale got started and why you guys exist?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to describe Tailscale is it's WireGuard on easy mode, right? It's the easiest way to connect all of your stuff together, all your devices, no matter where they are. So I think Tailscale was started in 2019, just a little bit pre-pandemic. It's a fully remote company started by a couple of ex-Googlers. Our CEO, Avery, is a bit behind like Google Fiber. In fact, I was talking to Avery when I first joined the company, And low-key, I just said, you know, I used to use a program called SSH Shuttle. And he was like, oh, yeah, I wrote that. So, you know, the company's just full of superstar developers. It's a real privilege to work here. But where we're at today is we've just crossed our 5,000th paying customer. Our business model, people often ask us, how does Tailscale stay free? And for the most part, the answer is we give it away for free. People think, oh, this is cool. This is solving a lot of problems for us. Maybe we could take it to work. And that's how Tailscale stays free.
So you get in with the geeks on the personal side, and then it goes into a paying customer if they bring it to work. Talk about the geek side for a little bit. So I'm a geek. I'm at home. I have a box. I maybe want access to it. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, the box is at my parents' house or a friend's house. They don't understand firewall rules. They don't know how to set it up. How do I get started with Tailscale?
Tailscale.com download is the easiest place to go to get started. In terms of what you need to know, really, as long as you download the client on both ends, log in, both of those devices will appear in what's called your tailnet, which is the name we give to like the logical grouping of Tailscale devices. That is a set of private devices just for you. So those two devices can now talk to each other doing something called NAT traversal. No firewall rules, as you mentioned. You know, you don't need to tweak anything like that. Those devices connect to each other through something called a DERP server, which is a Tailscale concept. Those run in the cloud, and they use that to kind of figure out where in the world these other two servers are, do the NAT traversal magic, and then establish a direct connection. That's in contrast to many other sort of VPN providers, which is a hub and spoke model. Tailscale is direct connection, so that means you get full line speed. You don't have to worry about bandwidth limits or anything. Oh, I mean, local bandwidth limits still apply, of course, but you're not worried about cloud providers throttling you or, you know, term to service or anything like that.
Now, is Tailscale, is it an open source product, or it's a service based on an open source product that is WireGuard?
Yes, I think. It's a bit of a complicated answer because all of the clients are open source. We have an open source control server implementation called Headscale. In fact, Tailscale actually employs one of the developers of Headscale in the company because we believe in it so much as being an important tenant. The core control server itself is closed source, but everything else about Tailscale is open. We also support the WireGuard project extensively as well because it's obviously what we've based our entire product stack around.
Now, if I'm a business and I want to get in, so I can use it at home for free. I think it's free up to like 100 machines, right?
100 devices, 3 users for free, yep.
So I get into a business and I say, okay, I want to start deploying this at scale. No pun intended. And so what do I need to know? How do I get started with my business?
Well, we have a sales team, like you would imagine any company does. You can reach out to us through different contact forms on our website if you want to. We have different paid tiers, so you can start just adding seats if you want to without speaking to us. We also have, you know, large companies we're working with. You know, we're talking thousands of seat companies that we're working with, and obviously there are volume discounts and that kind of stuff for those people. But yeah, like I mentioned, the business model is get the geeks in the door first, and the rest kind of follows on later, you know?
Very cool. What is coming up with Tailscale? What's new or exciting or coming down the road?
Oh, I don't know. Have we signed an NDA? I don't know what I can talk about. We did just add a bunch of stuff around mobile device posture. So let's say you have a fleet of mobile devices in your company. You want to make sure that person's running the latest version of Android or iOS or something like that, because there's a CVE that you haven't patched. We can deny connections for those devices unless they're running a specific version of an operating system. So mobile device management posture, device posture, it's a pretty standard like zero trust thing in the market these days. On the home user side, we just added subnet routing to Apple TV users. So why that might be useful is if you've got an Apple TV in your life, when it's off in standby mode, it's sort of running at 2 or 3 watts. We can use the network stack, even when it's in that 2 or 3 watt mode, to route traffic from your phone in your hand at the coffee shop out through your house where your Apple TV is as an exit node. So there's a bunch of different stuff depending on what you're interested in, home users, enterprise users. We kind of try and cover all bases, really. There's a lot happening.
As a person who does an extensive amount of self-hosting and home labbing stuff, self-hosted the podcast, what do you like about Tailscale? What drew you to the company not just for a passion project, but your employment?
I think originally I was trying to connect the services that I run at my mum's house in England with the services that I run in my basement in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I was trying to, at the time, roll my own WireGuard solution, like just write Ansible playbooks to roll the keys and all the rest of it. And it always fell down when I got to the mobile device side of things, because you can't really declaratively configure an iPhone or an Android phone very easily anyway. I tried to scale out, and I set aside a weekend to try it out, and I was done in 10 minutes. And it was kind of like holy moly moment of, that can't possibly be it. And so then, you know, I started moving into doing more YouTube content, that sort of thing, developer relations type work, and Red Hat started doing some layoffs, and I put some feelers out, and here we are, you know?
Very cool. Alex, we appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us. We'll get you back on the program soon.
Thanks for everything you do for the community as well, Noah. I know it's a long time ago now, but Linux Action Show was extremely motivational to a young Alex 10 years ago, so thank you for that.
I wanted to draw some attention this week to a couple of pieces of software that have maybe fallen by the wayside, but have had some real impact in the production world. The first of which is QLC Plus. So this came back into my life this week in part because, you know, back in college and shortly thereafter, I had a stint where we'd do events. We'd do weddings, we'd do parties, that sort of thing. And as a part of that, obviously, people want lights. And so to control them, it uses a protocol called DMX. DMX is one of the simplest lighting protocols out there. Basically, the way it works is you have channels. And channels can be assigned a value of 0 to 255. So 255 is the channel all the way on. 0 is the channel all the way off. Different fixtures can have different channel numbers. So for example, a very basic RGB light might have red, green, and blue. And so red is a channel, 0 to 255. Green is a channel, 0 to 255. Blue is a channel, 0 to 255. But you can do other things as well. So there is a company that makes basically these lit orbs, and they're on a hoist, and the orb can come down or it can raise up. So in that case, you also have the speed at which the orb can raise and lower, the distance from the ground or the how far out the orb is to come down, and you can set all of that via DMX. There are a number of ways to send DMX commands, the simple of which is to actually purchase an actual lighting control board. The high-end professional ones cost tens of thousands of dollars, and they're basically little mini computers. But if you've ever gone to a rock concert, if you've ever gone to a large show, you'll find that the vast majority of lighting, if it's not done by a dedicated control surface, is done with little lighting cues. And so you assemble all of your lighting scenes the way that you want each step in the song or each step in the set or each step along the way in the show to look. And then you set those up as cues. And then as those cues come up, you fire the cues. So this week I was asked to do some lighting, and so I was working with what they had there. And I wanted to wrap my head better around how all of that worked. And I thought, well, I'll bring it back into my friend QLC Plus. So I fired QLC Plus up and use the DMX King to connect up to some DMX lights. And what I learned was that, yes, you can do in QLC Plus the show thing that basically lays out all of the events on a timeline so you could sync it up with the show. But they also support something called chases. And chases are effectively a cue list. And so you set up the different scenes that you'd like to set with your DMX lights up, and you set them up as different steps in the chase. You then tell it, don't loop the chase, just run it one step by step, set a fade in time, set the whole time to be infinite, and Bob's your uncle. Now you can set your stage up one step after the other and then just advance through. And as you advance those cues, it sends the signals to the various lights and they turn on and off. The next step along this adventure, so there's a couple of things. One is the potential for QLC Plus to expand what is otherwise a locked-in system. So you have these organizations, and they purchase a set number of DMX channels that they're able to use with their system. Right now, again, they get locked in to the proprietary solution that says, well, you can only control this many fixtures, so you can only control this many channels. And after that, you have to pay us more money. So when they run out of money, what are they to do? I would like to be able to say, oh, well, you could use QLC Plus. That will accomplish these same things. The further I dug, the happier I was. So the first thing I came across this week that I didn't know about QLC Plus, it has a built-in web interface. So you can build a dashboard of lighting things to control. And QLC Plus will publish that as a web interface, and you click on the button and it fires off a series of DMX things. That's huge. So if you have an event center or a house of worship, something like that, and you want to be able to give people, normal people, control over some of the lights, you could build a little control panel that has, you know, all lights on or main house lights on or house lights on or something like that and lights off, publish that as a web UI, put that up on a tablet and let people control it that way. The second thing that came across my radar this week from QLC Plus is its ability to interface with network devices. So Alation makes something called the Enode 4. And this is how a lot of other pieces of software are able to talk DMX over the network. The Enode 4 has a DMX connection up to all of the fixtures, and then the Enode 4 just has an IP address. I went into QLC Plus, and I was pleasantly surprised to learn that it will just discover other devices that exist on its local subnet that it has the ability to talk to. And from there, you give it a universe and you start assigning DMX channel numbers, and it's able to talk as if it was another DMX device connected to the system. So I'll have links for you for the Alation Enode 4. I'll have links for you for QLC Plus. I haven't seen a lot of updates since about 2016, but I will tell you what, QLC Plus is absolutely one of those pieces of software that I look at and say that to me seems feature complete. Because in the end, we're not adding any more than 512 channels to a universe in the DMX world. In the end, we are not changing the values from anything from 0 to 255. So the ability to control devices of channels up to 512 from 0 to 255 was written in QLC Plus however many years ago and still continues to function today. And when I compare it with the software being made today, much of which is considerably more expensive than QLC Plus, I look back to what I've been using for 10 plus years and go, this thing is absolutely fantastic. I wonder why people don't talk about it more. And so as I reached out to some of the people, even in the Linux world, that I know do this for a living or have done this for a living, and said, hey, have you played with this? And have you? A lot of them are saying, I just not. Either they're doing something very hardware related, they're out of the industry, or they moved to something else. Not moved away from Linux, but they were never on it to begin with. And the more capable I find this software out to be, the more I'm like, if you were trying to, all the different ways that we have now to control RGB lights, and really in the end, it's underneath the hood, it's been DMX all the way along. Like, it has existed for a long time. We've made lights that way for a long time. We have things like ArtNet to interface with these things for a long time. All of this stuff has been around and has become the de facto industry standard in a lot of these places. And yet, I don't see Linux nerds leveraging this stuff. And I kind of ask myself, why is that? So, if you have ever had an interest in production-y things, if you've had an interest in music production, if you've had an interest in light production, if you've had an interest in producing things on Linux, I'd love to hear from you. Write into live@asknoahshow.com. Let me know what it is that you're doing, if you work in the industry, or the tools that you're using and how they're working on top of Linux. If you find this information useful, again, all of the information is linked in the show notes. You'll find those at podcast.asknoahshow there. Not only will you find the show notes for this episode, but you'll find the entire back catalog of the Ask Noah program. We're back next Tuesday, 6 p.m. Central, at asknoahshow.com. Have a good week.